Welcome to A Light on Chinese Literature from China Plus. Today we continue with the book The Spirit of the Chinese People by Malaysian Chinese scholar Gu Hongming. In this episode, the author talks about the greatest contribution of Confucius and that it was he who gave the Chinese people the idea of a state. Here is your narrator, Man Ling. Enjoy.
The greatest service which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation was that in saving the drawings and plans of their civilization, he made a new synthesis, a new interpretation of the plans of that civilization. And in that new synthesis, he gave the Chinese people the true idea of a state, a true, rational, permanent, absolute basis of a state. But then Plato and Aristotle in ancient times, and Rousseau and Herbert Spencer in modern times, also made a synthesis of civilization and tried to give a true idea of a state. Now, what is the difference between the philosophy, the synthesis of civilization made by the great men of Europe I have mentioned, and the synthesis of civilization, the system of philosophy and morality now known as Confucianism? The difference, it seems to me, is this. The philosophy of Plato and Aristotle and of Herbert Spencer has not become a religion, or the equivalent of a religion, the accepted faith of the masses of a people or nation, whereas Confucianism has become a religion, or the equivalent of a religion, to even the mass of the population in China. When I say religion here, I mean religion not in the narrow European sense of the word, but in the broad universal sense. Goethe says, "Only the mass of mankind know what is real life. Only the mass of mankind live a true human life." Now, when we speak of religion in its broad universal sense, we mean generally a system of teachings with rules of conduct which, as Goethe says, is accepted as true and binding by the mass of mankind, or at least by the mass of the population in a people or nation. In this broad and universal sense of the word, Christianity and Buddhism are religions. In this broad and universal sense, Confucianism, as you know, has become a religion as its teachings have been acknowledged to be true and its rules of conduct to be binding by the whole Chinese race and nation, whereas the philosophy of Plato, of Aristotle, and of Herbert Spencer has not become a religion, even in this broad universal sense. That, I say, is the difference between Confucianism and the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle and of Herbert Spencer. The one has remained a philosophy for the learned, whereas the other has become a religion, or the equivalent of a religion, for the mass of the whole Chinese nation, as well as for the learned of China. In this broad universal sense of the word, I say Confucianism is a religion, just as Christianity or Buddhism is a religion. But you will remember I said that Confucianism is not a religion in the European sense of the word. What is then the difference between Confucianism and a religion in the European sense of the word? There is, of course, the difference that the one has a supernatural origin and element in it, whereas the other has not. But besides this difference of supernatural and non-supernatural, there's also another difference between Confucianism and a religion in the European sense of the word, such as Christianity and Buddhism, and it is this. A religion in the European sense of the word teaches a man to be a good man. But Confucianism does more than this. Confucianism teaches a man to be a good citizen. The Christian Catechism asks, what is the chief end of man? But the Confucian Catechism asks, what is the chief end of a citizen of man? Not in his individual life, but man in his relation with his fellow men and in his relation to the state. The Christian answers the words of his catechism by saying, the chief end of man is to glorify God. The Confucianist answers the words of his catechism by saying, the chief end of man is to live as a dutiful son and a good citizen. Zhu Yu, a disciple of Confucius, is quoted in the Sayings and Discourses of Confucius, saying, a wise man devotes his attention to the foundation of life, the chief end of man. When the foundation is laid, wisdom, religion will come. Now, to live as a dutiful son and a good citizen, is not that the foundation, the chief end of man as a moral being? In short, a religion in the European sense of the word makes it its object to transform man into a perfect ideal man by himself, into a saint, a Buddha, an angel, whereas Confucianism limits itself to make man into a good citizen, to live as a dutiful son and a good citizen. In other words, a religion in the European sense of the word says, if you want to have religion, you must be a saint, a Buddha, an angel. Whereas Confucianism says, if you live as a dutiful son and a good citizen, you have religion. In fact, the real difference between Confucianism and religion in the European sense of the word, such as Christianity or Buddhism, is that the one is a personal religion, or what may be called a church religion, whereas the other is a social religion, or what may be called a state religion. The greatest service, I say, which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation is that he gave them a true idea of a state. Now, in giving this true idea of a state, Confucius made that idea a religion. In Europe, politics is a science. But in China, since Confucius' time, politics is a religion. In short, the greatest service which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation, I say, is that he gave them a social or state religion. Confucius taught this state religion in a book which he wrote in the very last days of his life, a book to which he gave the name of Chun Qiu, spring and autumn. Confucius gave the name of spring and autumn to this book because the object of the book is to give the real moral causes which govern the rise and fall, the spring and autumn of nations. This book might also be called the Latter-day Annals, like the Latter-day Pamphlets of Carlyle. In this book, Confucius gave a resume of the history of a false and decadent state of society and civilization, in which he traced all the suffering and misery of that false and decadent state of society and civilization to its real cause, to the fact that man had not a true idea of a state, no right conception of the true nature of the duty which they owe to the state, to the head of state, their ruler and sovereign. In a way, Confucius in this book taught the divine right of kings. Now, I know all of you, or at least most of you, do not now believe in the divine right of kings. I will not argue the point with you here. I will only ask you to suspend your judgment until you have heard what I have further to say. In the meantime, I would just ask your permission to quote to you here a saying of Carlyle. Carlyle says, the right of a king to govern us is either a divine right or a diabolic wrong. Now, I want you, on this subject of the divine right of kings, to remember and ponder over this saying of Carlyle.
From China Plus. China Plus. You're listening to A Light on Chinese Literature.
In this book, Confucius taught that as in all the ordinary relations and dealings between men in human society, there is, besides the base motives of interest and of fear, a higher and nobler motive to influence them in their conduct, a higher and nobler motive which rises above all considerations of interest and fear, the motive called duty. So in this important relation of all in human society, the relation between the people of a state or nation and the head of that state or nation, there's also this higher and nobler motive of duty, which should influence and inspire them in their conduct. But what is the rational basis of this duty which the people in a state or nation owe to the head of the state or nation? Now, in the feudal age before Confucius' time, with its semi-patriarchal order of society and form of government, when the state was more or less a family, the people did not feel so much the need of having a clear and firm basis for the duty which they owe to the head of the state, because as they were all members of one clan or family, the tie of kinship or natural affection already, in a way, bound them to the head of the state, who was also the senior member of their clan or family. But in Confucius' time, the feudal age, as I said, had come to an end, when the state had outgrown the family, when the citizens of a state were no longer composed of the members of a clan or family. It was, therefore, then necessary to find a new, clear, rational, and firm basis for the duty which the people in a state or nation owe to the head of the state, their ruler and sovereign. Now, what new basis did Confucius find for this duty? Confucius found the new basis for this duty in the word honor. When I was in Japan last year, the ex-minister of education, Baron Kikuchi, asked me to translate 4 Chinese characters taken from the book in which, as I said, Confucius taught this state religion of his. The 4 characters were Ming Fen Ta Yi. I translated them as the great principle of honor and duty. It is for this reason that the Chinese make a special distinction between Confucianism and all other religions by calling the system of teaching taught by Confucius not a Chao, the general term in Chinese for religion with which they designate other religions such as Buddhism, Mohammedanism, and Christianity, but the Ming Chao, the religion of honor. Again, the term Jun Zhu Zhi Dao in the teachings of Confucius, translated by Dr. Legge as the way of the superior man, for which the nearest equivalent in the European languages is moral law, means literally the way, the law of the gentleman. In fact, the whole system of philosophy and morality taught by Confucius may be summed up in one word, the law of the gentleman. Now, Confucius codified this law of the gentleman and made it a religion, a state religion. The first article of faith in this state religion is Ming Fen Ta Yi, the principle of honor and duty, which may thus be called a code of honor. In this state religion, Confucius taught that the only true, rational, permanent, and absolute basis, not only of a state, but of all society and civilization, is this law of the gentleman, the sense of honor in men. Now, you, all of you, even those who believe that there's no morality in politics, all of you, I think, know and will admit the importance of this sense of honor in men in human society. But I'm not quite sure that all of you are aware of the absolute necessity of this sense of honor in men for the carrying on of every form of human society. In fact, as the proverb which says, there must be honor even among thieves, show even for the carrying on of a society of thieves. Without the sense of honor in men, all society and civilization would on the instant break down and become impossible. Will you allow me to show you how this is so? Let us take, for example, such a trivial matter as gambling in social life. Now, unless men, when they sit down to gamble, all recognize and feel themselves bound by the sense of honor to pay when a certain color of cards or dice turns up, gambling would on the instant become impossible. The merchants again, unless merchants recognize and feel themselves bound by the sense of honor to fulfill their contracts, all trading would become impossible. But you will say that the merchant who repudiates his contract can be taken to the law court. True, but if there were no law courts, what then? Besides, the law court, how can the law court make the defaulting merchant fulfill his contract? By force. In fact, without the sense of honor in men, society can only be held together for a time by force. But then I think I can show you that force alone cannot hold society permanently together. The policeman who compels the merchant to fulfill his contract uses force. But the lawyer, magistrate, or president of a republic, how does he make the policeman do his duty? You know, he cannot do it by force. But then by what? Either by the sense of honor in the policeman or by fraud. In modern times, all over the world today, and I'm sorry to say now also in China, the lawyer, politician, magistrate, and president of a republic make the policeman do his duty by fraud. In modern times, the lawyer, politician, magistrate, and president of a republic tell the policeman that he must do his duty because it is for the good of society and for the good of his country, and that the good of society means that he, the policeman, can get his pay regularly, without which he and his family would die of starvation. The lawyer, politician, or president of a republic who tells the policeman this, I say, uses fraud. I say it is fraud because the good of the country, which for the policeman means 15 shillings a week, which barely keeps him and his family from starvation, means for the lawyer, politician, magistrate, and president of a republic 10 to 20,000 pounds a year, with a fine house, electric light, motor cars, and all the comforts and luxuries which the lifeblood labor of 10,000 of men has to supply him. I say it is fraud, because without the recognition of a sense of honor, the sense of honor which makes the gambler pay the last penny in his pocket to the player who wins from him, without this sense of honor, all transfer and possession of property, which makes the inequality of the rich and poor in society, as well as the transfer of money on the gambling table, has no justification whatever and no binding force. Thus, the lawyer, politician, magistrate, or president of a republic, although they talk of the good of society and the good of the country, really depend upon the policeman's unconscious sense of honor, which not only makes him do his duty, but also makes him respect the right of property and be satisfied with 15 shillings a week, while the lawyer, politician, and president of a republic receive an income of 20,000 pounds a year. I, therefore, say it is fraud because while they thus demand the sense of honor from the policeman, they, the lawyer, politician, magistrate, and president of a republic in modern society, believe, openly say, and act on the principle that there is no morality, no sense of honor in politics. In fact, a society without a sense of honor in men and without morality in its politics cannot, I say, be held together, or at any rate, cannot last. For in such a society, the policeman, upon whom the lawyer, politician, magistrate, and president of a republic depend to carry out their fraud, will thus argue with himself. He is told that he must do his duty for the good of society. But he, the poor policeman, is also a part of that society to himself and his family, at least the most important part of that society. Now, if by some other way than by being a policeman, perhaps by being an anti-policeman, he can get better pay to improve the condition of himself and his family, that also means the good of society. In that way, the policeman must sooner or later come to the conclusion that as there's no such thing as a sense of honor and morality in politics, there is then no earthly reason why, if he can get better pay, which means also the good of society, no reason why, instead of being a policeman, he should not become a revolutionist or anarchist. In a society, when the policeman once comes to the conclusion that there's no reason why, if he can get better pay, he should not become a revolutionist or anarchist, that society is doomed. Mencius said, when Confucius completed his Spring and Autumn Annals, the book in which he taught the state religion of his, and in which he showed that the society of his time, in which there was then, as in the world today, no sense of honor in public men and no morality in politics, was doomed. When Confucius wrote that book, the Jesuits and anarchists of his time became afraid. But to return from the digression, I say, a society without a sense of honor cannot be held together, cannot last. For if, as we have seen, even in the relation between men connected with matters of little or no vital importance, such as gambling and trading in human society, the recognition of the sense of honor is so important and necessary, how much more so it must be in the relations between men in human society, which establish the two most essential institutions in that society, the family and the state.
This has been a China Plus production. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe to the podcast for free. If you have any comments about the episodes, just send us an email, podcast@cri.com.cn. We are also on Facebook and Twitter @China Plus News.